Is solar energy today? We are joined again by our Wall Street Insider correspondent, the proprietor of Climateer Investing blog. Well, welcome and thanks for giving us some of your valuable time.
Alex, what a great time to be alive.
You bet.
I really mean that. When we left last time, you said, well, on that optimistic note, you're absolutely right.
Well, let's start out. I want to ask, is solar energy still a development project, or is it becoming a real industry?
As to size, it's still very tiny, and we'll get to that. First off, though, for your older listeners, I want to make a point. I know you asked me not to go into a lot of history, but what we're going to talk about today is not what I think of as hippie solar. When I was a kid, the idea seemed to be that everyone would live in a geodesic dome and have a solar panel to run their Techniques power amplifier, and they'd have a light bulb so they could read the whole Earth catalog. And thank goodness that's all they did. They had very simple lives because those solar panels in 1975 cost $100 a watt. It's down to $2 a watt and dropping right now. I mean, that's an incredible drop, 50-fold over the last 33 years. So it's not what a lot of older folks, myself included, would think of as solar. This is beyond the cutting edge. And if, well, we can take a moment here to go back to your original question, the develop versus developing. One quick example of where the industry is right now. CleanEdge put out a report 3 or 4 weeks ago. The entire solar industry worldwide did about $20 billion in revenues in 2007. One company in Canada, did a bit over $21 billion. So they're smaller than Canada's largest energy company, much less an ExxonMobil or a Chevron. It's still very, very tiny. But, and this is the important thing, when I first came into business, there was a story going around about a couple of shoe salesmen back in the 50s. They're sent off to Africa and told, sell. They get to Africa, one shoe salesman wires back, lousy market, nobody wears shoes here. The other shoe salesman says, great market, nobody wears shoes here. And it really is all on how you look at it. Coming from a $20 billion base, the upside is so big, that's the reason that the big venture capitalists, the big investment banks, are plowing really big money into this. The CleanEdge, again, in their report from earlier this month, said they expect 3.5 to 4-fold growth. They expect about a $70 billion industry 10 years out. That might end up being on the low side. Things are happening so fast, Alex, that, well, if you had any specific questions, why don't you just jump on in, because I could go on with this stuff for hours.
Well, I'm quite willing to let you go on for hours because I think you know what you're talking about. But let's just start with this one. As you know, Southern California Edison just announced plans to build the country's biggest solar installation. It's going to cost $875 million. That should give the American market a bit of a sign or a lift or a signal, don't you think?
Oh, my goodness. That one project is so large in scope. Just the thinking behind it, it's what we call utility-scale solar. And, again, it is not the little panels on the roof. This is meant to be competitive on a cost basis with coal-fired electricity, and that is the holy grail. We'll get into some of the subsidies and whatever that have made solar grow as fast as it has. But the real goal of all of this, and the SoCal Edison, as you say, just shy of a $1 billion investment, that's a big bet. The fellows at Google, especially Sergey Brin, are backing a company called NanoSolar their goal is to get electricity out of nanosolar cells cheaper than coal-fired. They announced earlier this year, or maybe it was late December, they had achieved 99 cents per watt, cell cost, which means usually you double the cost of the cell. So let's say $1 a watt, you double that to get your installed cost of $2. This goes back to something we talked about the first time I called in. The last coal-fired power plant that I looked at was going to cost approximately $2 billion to generate 1,000 megawatts, or $2 a watt for their fixed cost. Well, it appears that NanoSolar has already achieved that goal of being competitive on a cost basis. And with that, the sky really is the limit. There are so many approaches going on right now, and maybe this would be a good time to just give a quick overview of the different types. Is that okay?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, right now in solar panels, the two main types are silicon-based, which is the stuff that has created the entire semiconductor world we live in, and what's called thin film. The advantages of silicon, A, it's an established technology. The fabricators that actually make wafers of silicon know how to do this, and they are very good at getting the purity you need. What you're trying to do is take those photons from the sun, excite the electrons in whatever material you're using as your semiconductor, so that the electrons step up in energy phase and then create an electrical current. The doing it with semiconductor material is very straightforward. It's been a problem for the last 2 years because the growth has been so fast, there have been acute shortages of silicon. That's ending right now. This month and next month, we'll start to see new supplies coming online. But it has driven the cost of silicon through the roof, so that when it was already a more expensive process or approach, it really got expensive. The other major type is what's called thin film, where you're applying a film which is going to be the semiconductor to some sort of substrate or backing. Right now, the leader in that area is a company called First Solar out of Phoenix. First Solar uses a combination of cadmium and tellurium. This NanoSolar that I had mentioned earlier uses a tongue twister. I'll just call it SIGS because it's a copper, indium, gallium, selenide. And I don't want to have to keep saying that. Okay, with SIGS, this compound of metals and chemicals is inefficient on a comparison basis with the silicon, except just last Monday, and Alex, this is how fast the industry is moving. Just last Monday, the Department of Energy here in the U.S., their National Renewable Energy Lab, the NREL, which has been a major key player in all of the development, announced they had achieved 19.9% conversion efficiency. The average conversion efficiency of silicon right now is about 20.3%, so they're within half a percentage point of matching silicon's efficiency with a lot cheaper manufacturing technique. This is where it breaks wide open. With the two types, even with the shortage of silicon being solved in the new supply coming on, it looks like a thin film is going to rule for the next few years at minimum.
It almost sounds like a Blu-ray versus HD war, where one comes out on top, or will both be used extensively?
Nope. One will come out on top, and it'll be a function of cost and price. And in this case, I think it'll be the Blu-ray. I think it'll be the thin film. The reason for that, and this is, I don't mean to get all philosophical, but there's enough money to do anything, but there's not enough money to do everything. So as we go forward in solar, we have to choose a standard to go with. Now, there is a third type, and this refers to these large utility-scale installations called concentrated or concentrating solar, where rather than making the electricity directly by exciting electrons, they heat a salt brine to, I think it's over 700 degrees, and use that heat energy to then power a standard turbine. That is going to be a very competitive technology. It's just being scaled up right now. But for the foreseeable 3 to 5 years, it'll be panels made with thin film, I believe.
Well, who are some of the big solar players, and what have you heard about large installations overseas?
Okay, right now, the largest manufacturer is Sharp Electronics. Using their expertise in semiconductors, in 2006, they produced 25% of all the solar cells in the world. The second large player is a company in Germany called Q-Cells. They did, I believe it was on the order of 250 megawatts to Sharp's 400 and something, I think 430 or 440. Then you have a Chinese company, Suntech, another Japanese company, Kyocera, and Sanyo. So because they were using the silicon, the major players were the electronics manufacturers. That's changing right now. As I said, First Solar is coming on. They had the most dramatic price appreciation that you can imagine. They came public at $20 a share. Within 13 months, the stock was at 283, better than ninefold in just over a year. It was madness. It was a bubble. And the stock subsequently dropped off into the 160s. It's now back up, though, into the 210 range. Pardon me, 230 range. It just had a recent run-up. So the thin film is recognized as being competitive. But First Solar's problem is with their cadmium telluride approach, they don't have the efficiency. They have the low cost, but they don't have the efficiency. Companies like this NanoSolar out of California, which, by the way, is backed by the Google guys. I mean, very smart technology people seem to be gravitating to this. The venture capitalists, the ones that basically built Yahoo, Kleiner Perkins, are in this. That's also the firm that Al Gore recently joined, that are in this up to their eyeballs. So it's a very high-tech approach, which is why I let off saying it's not hippie solar at all anymore.
Well, even some big oil companies who have billions to invest are buying solar companies, and they use that in their advertising, but it seems their actual solar production is pretty tiny. Or do you think they could be sincere about getting into this new energy?
Well, it's intriguing in that British Petroleum, BP, has been in solar since 1973. They were one of the largest, but when Lord Brown was asked to leave as CEO, the new CEO decided that they were going back to their carbon roots. The Shell was also a major player, but they sold their solar. I mean, by major, they were in the top 10. They sold their solar business. So I think it's as much PR and branding, and I won't go so far as to say greenwashing, because they actually did produce product. But I don't see them going forward because, A, they don't have the technological expertise that Silicon Valley and Tokyo and now Beijing can draw on. It is a whole new world out there. You, in our recording discussion last time, asked me if I was afraid about something coming out of some lab that I had never heard of and just changing the ball game. That was an astute question as any non-investor I've ever heard from. The reason is, here's just one example. there's a company called Konarka that is developing a thin film that you can actually apply with an inkjet printer. I mean, if you can do that, it skips right past NanoSolar, which uses big reel-to-reel printers to lay down their ultra-cheap stuff. There's a technology called, goodness, let me make sure I get this right, quantum dots, whereby applying a nano-manufactured nano-composite to the thin film, you extend the range of the spectrum that the light will absorb. With a quantum dot, you can actually generate electricity from infrared, which means you could theoretically create electricity in the dark. And this is the kind of thing that really does scare me as an investor in some of the what are now cutting-edge technologies, but that could be eclipsed by some fella in a small lab somewhere. It's that dynamic.
I appreciate that. And meanwhile, I want to ask you one big question. You know, we're told that the market system will take care of climate change somehow, but I wonder, is there a problem in the necessary medium of capital investment in solar? Are people too nervous to get in, or do you think it's getting the investment it needs?
Well, no, it's not getting the investment it needs. And one of the problems is the venture capital mindset it's just too short term. And the reason for it is, I mean, yeah, you can fund a genius software developer and have a product out on the street in 18 months and be generating revenues. But with the energy stuff, you've got to be looking for longer term paybacks and be aware of that as you go into it. So the venture capitalists on Sand Hill Road want to be there because they know that the payoffs will be huge, but they don't want to commit to 5, 10, 15, 20-year payoff periods, which is what you're looking at in energy. Even in oil and natural gas, from the time you discover the field to the time that you're actually producing can be 10, 12 years, much less when you're creating brand new technologies. And then going through the process of commercializing them, going through the learning curve to bring down production costs, getting the stuff out there and actually generating revenues. So that there is a real problem. I mentioned the National Renewable Energy Lab from the Department of Energy. They have been critical in the development of, they work with First Solar, Solar on their cadmium telluride. If it hadn't been for the NREL, that would never have come to be. It's going to have to be a public-private partnership. And here's where I differ from some of my capitalist friends. I think the public purse should either A, get a piece of the rewards down the road, and I mean just in the form of societal benefits. I mean cash money. Or B, rather than subsidies, and I do want to get to those shortly, There should be grand prizes. I have this picture of what a $500 million prize would do to stimulate research in the private sector. And it'd be a one-time payoff, and that'd be it. There'd be no subsidies going forward. Here's where I have a problem with subsidies. As an investor, you are so dependent on the politician's whim. If they think the wind is blowing against subsidies, they're gone. And then you run into the same situation the U.S. has had since 1980, where you start ramp development, the subsidies go, and your legs are cut out from under you. It's happening right now in the U.S., although Nancy Pelosi says she's going to bring up the subsidies for a vote on Earth Day coming up here in April. It's fine and dandy to have government approach it from the subsidy angle, but as an investor, I'd much prefer some sort of incentive just to get the cost below that of coal-fired electricity, in which case you won the game right there. Does that make sense to you?
It does indeed. And I also appreciate your idea of the public-private partnership, where the public gets some reward for government money invested when this does pay off.
I tell you, that does not fly on Wall Street, but it really can work. That there is no reason that the federal treasuries cannot participate. When the U.S. bailed out Chrysler, they got warrants to purchase stock. If the company succeeded, it did survive. The treasury was more than amply compensated for the risk that they took on guaranteeing the debt. So it's not unprecedented. Going forward here, back to the subsidies, I want to approach this real quickly. One example of how politicians change their mind. Germany, for the last 2 years, has been the fastest growing market for solar. And that was because they had very substantial, what they call feed-in tariffs, where once the stuff is on your roof, you can sell electricity back to the grid. Well, late last year, they decided they were going to shift the subsidies from solar to wind. And that meant that all the solar infrastructure that had been built dependent on subsidies, and it's that dependency thing as much as anything that's the problem, well, it was all of a sudden left high and dry. And now wind is going to be developed. The Germans are doing this for strategic reasons. They don't want to be dependent on Russian natural gas and coal. So they do have a reason for doing this, but it's a real problem as an investor. It's called rent seeking. When you're in a rent seeking business, you better be aware of it, because if you're dependent on the politicians, and you aren't keeping your finger to the wind as to what the prevailing view is, you really can lose a lot of money. Right now, Ontario has the highest feed-in tariff in the world. I believe it's 42 cents a kilowatt, and that is driving the industry in Ontario. But if that were to drop off, solar doesn't make a lot of sense when there's snow on the solar panel. And they might actually decide, well, maybe we should go with wind, too. An example of subsidy has gone crazy is Oregon, where there are enough different programs where if you game the system just right, you can put the panels on your roof and walk away with cash in hand. I think that's nuts. But there should be some in the game from the person who's putting the panels on the roof, much less getting cash out of the deal on top of it. But it's just a philosophical thing going forward, that the whole goal is to get the cost below the price of coal-fired electricity. However we get there, we get there. It's debatable going forward. One other point I want to make, I don't know the fellow, but a man named Tom Conrad at Alt Energy Stock, it's another blog, had a very thoughtful piece earlier this month on whether subsidies are a wealth transfer from the poor to the rich. And he came down, after really laying out the arguments on both sides, that yes, the poor, because they can't afford solar panels, they can't afford the upfront cost, but they do pay to subsidize those who can. It is a wealth transfer, but the societal good is big enough. I have one example that I think is obscene. General Electric, largest company in the world, makes solar cells. The state of Connecticut has a program that if you install solar on your roof, they will give you a grant to help subsidize it. General Electric applied for that grant and received it to install General Electric solar cells on General Electric headquarters. Now, on its face, that's ridiculous, but it's even worse. The city of Bridgeport's one of the poorest cities in the United States. In fact, I think it's the poorest of its size in the country. Every ratepayer in Bridgeport had to help support General Electric's putting their own solar cells on their roof. And it's stuff like that just drives me nuts. If there's a way to cut that kind of big business gaming of the system, I want to know about it, and I want to try to have a voice going forward here.
Well, despite these problems, as we wrap up, what is your gut feeling? Do you think solar will one day be the primary energy source for civilization?
Yeah. You know, Alex, just again, this stuff is so recent. 2 days ago, an MIT professor said it's the only way when you really look at it. If I was a lot younger and going to school right now, the three things I would do is, A, I would learn Mandarin, because you're going to have to know Chinese if you're going to deal on the world stage. B, I would get as broad an education as I could, because as we learn in Ecology 101, everything is connected. The more data points you have, the more connections you can make. And three, I would keep up with my math skills, because if you're willing to do what other people aren't willing to do, you'll be allowed to live like no one else can live. It really is a heck of an opportunity. People are only at their best when the challenges are big, and this is a big challenge, and it's going to bring out the best in a lot of people.
Well, once again, thank you for giving away your valuable insight, and listeners can get more of that every day from climateerinvest.blogspot.com. I'll let you go, but I hope we can talk again.
Alex, there's so much more to this. I look forward to the opportunity.
All right. This is Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. We'll go out with the Dan Bergson song, Power From Above, which I'd like to dedicate to all the hippies out there with solar panels who will at least have, well, some music and a little bit of light if the big system goes out from time to time.
Sinners, are you ready for a little redemption, to receive forgiveness for what we've done? The time has come to break bad habits. It's time to turn to the wind and sun. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. Yes, there's salvation in the power from above.